Hi, I'm Lawrence Diamond.
And I'm Bob Matthews.
And this is The Process of Production.
Mate, how's your week been?
It's been good, thank you very much. We just had a really fun little get-together at the studio, just invited a few producer friends of mine, including quite a few former guests of the podcast.
Nice.
Down to just have a few beers and see the place. And it was really fun, sort of culminating in like a 8-person synth jam, like messing around on the synth rig in the Neve room, which was really, really fun.
Is that going to be tracked and released on like white vinyl?
Maybe the quality wasn't quite at that level. Let's put it that way.
I seem to remember Gordon Raphael in our episode saying that at the peak of his Strokes days, he had a massive room in his house in London with just loads of synths rigged into massive reverb pedals. And I got the impression he spent a few hours in there just pressing one button on an arpeggiator and just living in that world. It can be quite enjoyable.
Yeah, that's fun. Yeah, that was kind of the aim. I sort of set it up before everyone came over so that you could just press on any of the synths and make a noise, and then just ran everything through a bit of reverb, and it was quite spacey.
And you've also been doing some other work in the studio to kind of get things on fleek, as it were.
Yeah, so one of the guys that works out of Hackney Road, Tim Southorne, is a sort of acoustics expert. He knows everything there is to know about acoustic treatment and all the science of it and stuff. And one of the rooms is a long way from being ideal, so he had an idea about make these custom made boxes. So I was in the studio yesterday while we were sort of sawing up a load of wood and filling it with acoustic treatment. To be honest, I've never paid too much heed to all that kind of acoustic treatment stuff. I've just sort of got like dealt with it with wherever I am, but it's nice to learn a bit more about it from a real geek on the subject.
It's one thing I've always wanted to get into, and it's always just seemed impenetrable, but everyone I speak to says that it can be the biggest change to your room, more than gear or speakers or even like your ability and knowledge. Like just having a very well-balanced room that you understand can just make all the difference. And obviously most of the rooms in Hackney Road are in that space, and I know a lot of the studios you've worked out, you kind of have already had that, but it's definitely something that when I find my new space, I'd like to dial into a bit more and just make the small changes that can make a lot of difference for the workflow.
Apparently, I mean, to be honest, I've not made up my mind over like how important I perceive it to be. Maybe as I do more and more mixing, it'll become crucial. But like even amongst all of us at Hackney Road, there's like opinion is divided on like whether or not it's worth doing this stuff.
One thing that the acoustic treatment wasn't necessary for was for tracking our next interview, which we did at least 66.66% recurring at Hackney Road Studio.
Yeah.
I unfortunately had to dial in. I had planned to be there, but I had other commitments. But yourself and Luke and myself, via the wonders of the internet, did this interview in the studio space, which is always exciting as well.
Yeah, it was really nice to welcome Luke Smith to the studio, and it was kind of useful to have him in the space as well, because he could refer to certain pieces of gear that were in front of him when he was making examples, and also being in that part of London reminded him of an interesting part of his career where he was working on Game Boy music that we get into in the interview, and he might not have even remembered that if he hadn't walked past the building where he used to do it.
Yeah, and Luke came to prominence with his band Claw in the early mid-noughties. Brilliant. I hesitate to say electroclash because that word is so like tainted now, but they were kind of really avant-garde in a kind of alternative rock electro.
It was that sort of scene where like sort of just in the immediate kind of post-Strokes world where indie guitar music and kind of club music were
meeting for the first time in a new way.
To some extent.
Yeah, he came to prominence with Claw, but then he also produced Total Life Forever for Foals, which was such an incredible record for them. And we also talk about his work with Keaton Henson. He's also worked with Friars, Theme Park, Eugene McGuinness. Some really exciting and interesting artists. Really great career. One of the artists that he worked with, Bob, was
none other than Citizens.
Yes.
The nascent Citizens.
The nascent Citizens. Yeah, I think it is. Like very early on in my old band's career, just as we were getting to the point of starting to record some of our demos, we were put in touch with Luke, mainly because we really loved Claw.
And
we talk a little bit about it in the episode. We didn't end up making a record with Luke, but I have really vivid memories of that session. It was a really exciting session. And he, just to kind of fill in a bit of more on what me and Luke talk about, but he built a sort of setup in the studio so we could perform these songs that had up to that point just been demos. We could sort of perform them live so that they were live, but they were electronic. And it was a really interesting process. And I actually think we maybe weren't at a point where we could understand what he was trying to do with our work. And that's maybe why we didn't end up working with him. But it heavily influenced how we then ended up working mm-hmm. with Alex Kapranos from Franz Ferdinand on our first record. And also how we ended up performing.
After chatting to Luke, I can see why, yeah.
Now, I actually really enjoyed kind of 10 years later coming back to talk about that time with Luke. And I found this one of my most enjoyable episodes to listen back to.
Yeah.
Because I really like Luke's manner and he just dispenses a lot of interesting information in a really interesting way.
Yeah, he's got loads of great insights and like kind of intriguing takes on stuff, which we can get into after the interview.
He also just has some great stories about making that Foles record.
Yeah, we really spend the bulk of the interview talking about that time and how he approached it and what he learned from it, because it is a really interesting record and it's a pivotal one in his career and Foles' career.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, anything else to say? Should we listen?
No, let's get into it. Luke Smith is a British record producer and musician who emerged in the early mid-noughties with his innovative and critically acclaimed band, Claw. Having split up after their first album, he immediately embarked on a production career and found early success with his work on Foles' sophomore album, Total Life Forever. As well as cracking the top 10, it received a Mercury Award nomination and elevated the band to a new stratosphere in the British alternative and rock scene. Work with Slow Club, Crystal Fighters and Keaton Henson has followed. He now works out of his space in East London, but it was in Bob's space in East London, Hackney Studios, where we sat down to discuss his path into production, that Foles record, and his reverence for the gear and spaces that make recording and producing music such a special and beautiful job.
Why don't we go back to the beginning of like your first steps into production? Because we both know you from your band Claw back in the early noughties. Lawrence and I were both kind of very much into that indie scene. Cool. Did your steps into production start even before that band?
So I've been playing in bands since I was very young. So I did my first tour when I was like 14.
Wow.
And I ended up doing like session work for bands and stuff. And I had my own band and we were signed back in the days when record deals were done by fax, which was long. Yeah. So I used to have a band. We did fairly well when I was 16 or 17. And then I ended up doing a lot of session work. I can't sight read or anything, just on the guitar, just because you can pick things up pretty quick.
Right, nice.
And then I ended up doing a session on Hornsey Road in a studio called Sweet Georgia Brown's for a guy that lived about 10 meters away from here.
Okay.
He was in this like sort of motorcycle rock band. And he asked me to go and play guitar, and it was really good fun. And we did this recording, and then afterwards he asked me if I wanted to go and work for him making Game Boy music.
Incredible.
Oh, wow.
At that point, I didn't even have an email address. This is like late 90s, and the internet was a bit of a mystery, although I did have a few very complicated samplers.
Right.
So I told him that I could use a computer, even though I had the only computer I'd use was an Atari ST. Really showing my years here, but so I went to his house and it was literally just a few minutes away from here, and we did Game Boy music with three channels of sort of a pulse wave and a noise channel.
That's incredible.
Wow.
Was busting out like 20 songs a week for like 2 or 3 years. Songs, I call them.
Was it hard work? Was it fun?
Well, it's good fun. Yeah, I mean, I actually think you get a lot of discipline because, I mean, we had to do it in DOS at first.
Wow,
wow. Yeah.
And I knew nothing about programming, so it's a little bit different. So you just had to type in the frequency of the waveform and the cycle of the waveform. You know, like what sort of pulse width you're going to use.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you had to sort of just run the commands.
Yeah.
And then, if there was an error, you just had to go and sort of sift through
it.
No
way.
That make you think about music completely differently, right? As a bunch of numbers.
It did actually. But in a way, like you sort of start, you just have like a chart. So it's not that. And you just sit there with your guitar and you just.
I see. Translate from, okay, what's a G?
You just make a little riff and then you try and make it sound like that. But what is quite good is that it's just a different way of thinking about music. So I was still in bands. I was still writing sort of like the music of the time, and But doing this as a job, as opposed to like working in Tesco's or the post office or as a temp or all my other millions of jobs.
Yeah, okay.
It's kind of nice to have like a different perspective on your normal thing.
Yeah.
So I think in that way it was very beneficial. And you know, you need to be economic, but also in that context, you don't really want music to be catchy because people might be playing a game for an hour. You don't want it to be buzzing around their head. So you start thinking about, you know, the opposite that you would do in sort of pop music or whatever.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting. I mean, over the years I've done other things as well that I think have a similar sort of function. Like I've done sound for films, just recording the sound and things like that. And yeah, just listening to sound in a non-musical context can actually really influence the way that you work in the studio, work as a musician in a really positive way, I think.
And the way you think about audio, you're thinking about audio in a way, and
rather
than song or product, or it's kind of a different space.
For example, I was doing this documentary in Greece, and I remember walking through these ruins with my sound gear on, and you could just hear all the insects like really, really loud. And then you start hearing the insects as the frequencies and the detail. It's like hyper reality.
Cool.
And it's super interesting. And then you get back into the studio and you sort of want to try and recreate some of those sounds that you've heard. And yeah,
it's funny you mentioned that, because I remember talking to you about, I'm jumping way ahead here, but I remember you said that when you worked on the Foles record, you did a lot of things that I was trying to remember them specifically, and I was talking to Bob and reading my diaries and stuff. But like, if a song was about something, say the Sahara, or you would try and bring in sort of like associative ideas into the sonics to relate to the song titles or emotion.
Yeah.
Am I remembering that right? And could you talk about that?
That's
a bit?
I always try and do that. I still try and do that. I haven't got any new tricks. that was what the album was about, really, sonically speaking, from my perspective at least, was trying to reinforce Yanis's lyrics and the feel of the song with, you know, sometimes literal interpretations. So one of the big tracks, Spanish Sahara, there was Dirty Waves was a lyric. And so we literally used like a big noise waveform, which we actually got Jimmy to play the guitar part in the dark, and we made a sort of big microphone out of an old snare drum skin and a contact mic, and we mic'd him up. And when he moved his arm and hand to play the chord, it sort of like made this big like.
Wow,
really complicated sort of white noise sound.
Yeah, I was listening to it yesterday and I was wondering what the...
it's this sort of like snare drum skin contact mic scenario.
Mm.
And and then we sort of just did some compression on the way in, and it sort of created this sort of like, it's supposed to sort of be reminiscent of the sea.
Yeah, it definitely is. At one point, I thought it might be a field recording, but I love the way it kind of rises going into the next chord. Is that
it's literally the way that Jimmy's moving as he's playing the chords. It's sort of triggering this sort of like chain of events.
Sounds very cool.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, I still do that. I think it's nice. I think we're trying to be, when we're listening to music or making music, we're trying to evoke something or we're trying to reinforce an atmosphere or an idea or a concept that went into the original writing phase, and it's nice to experiment with that sort of stuff, even if people don't actually notice. I think it all sort of contributes to the end result. Well, I hope it does.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I think as well it inspires artists who can sometimes feel a pressure of going into a recording, or are we just recreating this live, and it sort of expands their palette and makes them enjoy it as an experience of creating a record rather than having this pressure on to just do this. Like, oh, we're actually going to explore these things.
Yeah, I mean, and ultimately it's a language, isn't it? Music is a language in a way. Me and Lawrence both have small children, and before they can speak, the first thing you do is sort of, I sort of sang out of tune to mine. I'm sure you sang in tune to yours. But
possibly also out of tune, yeah. There was a reason.
And they seem to understand it, though, don't they? They respond and they love it. So it's our first language in a way.
Mm.
And it's not always obvious to us how it works. And that's the beauty of it in many ways. Like, we're sort of communicating with timbre, sound, pitch. And it's this, it seems to be that everybody is really good at understanding it on an emotional level, but not on a sort of intellectual level as much.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Do you see the role of the producer sometimes to join that intellectual to the emotional, I think?
I don't know. I try more and more to do less and less. No, I wouldn't say that. I just think that what I would like to get to do with my work is facilitate what the artist is looking for, and maybe even, you know, expand that a little, so that if an artist is trying to create a certain sensation or a certain feel with their record, or a certain mood, tried to push that as much as possible so that it's really resonant, so the listener can hear the song and then take that mood away with them. For me, it's a little bit like playing guitar or something else. To make that actually happen genuinely, we have to not think about it too much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because otherwise it starts to sound contrived and forced and weird. So in a way, like, the less we do, the easier it is to access that sort of cool stuff.
That's very good advice. I think that's another less is more scenario that we've come across before, but that's said in a really succinct and beautiful way. I think that's great. Can we go back to that Foles album, Total Life Forever, and talk a bit more about your memories of working on that? Because it was a big step forward for them. They'd had the first album, and you know, we can roll out the difficult second album cliche, but they'd had a lot of buzz and a lot of like hype around them for the first record. But artistically, the second record is quite different and a big step forward. And you could say it kind of set them up for where they are now as kind of like one of the premier kind of rock bands that's doing interesting and experimental stuff, yet still retaining a commercial edge.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question. So when we first spoke about doing it, I said I wasn't really interested in making a difficult second album. I thought we should make an epic third album.
Okay.
Nice.
So we just decided to skip the second album.
Yes.
And I went and stayed with them in their flat, or their house, sorry, in Oxford for a week.
Right.
And we just went to the pub and talked about sort of films and books and
as you do.
Yeah, and that sort of stuff. And Yanis was reading a book by Ray Kurzweil, The Singularity Is Near, I think, which I read as well.
Okay,
nice.
And just tried to sort of get into a sort of similar headspace. And then we took I took a punt on the studio in Gothenburg.
Amazing.
Svenska Gramophone Studios. And we just decided to just go out there and do it. Even though I'd never been there, I spoke to the guy, Calle, who runs it, on the phone, and it just had everything we needed. It had like a beautiful old Neve desk, like a really amazing one with lots of heritage, all the mics you can imagine, and four or five different acoustic environments.
Great.
And it was residential. So we just went there and we just did our best. And I mean, it was definitely wasn't the easiest record to make. But then again, I don't think things are always easy. No matter what you're doing, like sometimes when you're sort of really trying to achieve something really special, you have to work really hard. And I think that's true with anything. If you're learning a language, you have to work really hard. If you're learning a new skill, you have to work really hard. And I guess we were learning how to make a big epic Foles record. And we did lots of cool stuff, and we tried all sorts of interesting things, and lots of the sounds on that album are experiments in engineering, experiments in performance. We really did push ourselves as hard as it's possible to push yourself in that situation.
Right.
For both of you, you're quite early on in your careers. Like, that's quite bold to kind of have that confidence to do that. You know, for yourself, it's, you know, you're being trusted with this successful band's important second album, and for them as well, they could have easily gone in and gone, could we just make sure this hits at Radio One, or what, you know, whatever they say.
Luckily, I think that the guys were all really into progressive sort of sound and literally into sound and engineering and recording.
Okay.
It was a nice marriage in terms of the way that the music was written and the way that the music was recorded was a faithful sort of study of what we could do with a bunch of microphones and
nice.
You know, several people in a room playing.
Got you.
We did a lot of interesting things. It wasn't gimmicky. It was just like we were just trying to get the most emotion out of the sound. So a lot of the things that sound like Soundtoys plugins are actually like a tape machine going through every channel one after the other. Mm. And that's the natural delay of the tape. And things that like sound like reverbs are like multiple stairwells sort of feeding back into each other and things like that. I mean, it's easy to whack a Valhalla on, but we were doing it with the stairwells, as people have been for, you know, 60 years in studios. But that's nice if you're performing and you know that the reverb that's coming back at you is something that's echoing around the building at 1 o'clock in the morning in Sweden. It's cool. Makes you feel cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that adds a certain percentage that you don't get with the plugin, you think?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think you can get to these places in a number of ways, but because the guys in Foles were so into the art of recording.
Yes.
And the art and the quality of sound, I think that it definitely made a difference to performance and intention.
I think we've sort of talked about this as well, like, and you've alluded it to there, like, it's fun making a record. And sometimes it's not that fun just dialing up the Valhalla plugin that works every Tuesday when you're just putting a demo together. It can be quite fun to hang three microphones down a stairwell and then put a Spring Reverb amp at the bottom and drop it and see what it sounds like, because...
Yeah, I mean, actually, sometimes you do that and you don't even use it, but it just sets up this fun vibe.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
That's what
it's all about.
A creative atmosphere, you know, where you can try things and things are exciting. And I still try to do something that I've never done before on every recording. You know, just when you're sort of cycling into the studio or whatever, you just try and think of something that might work.
Yeah.
Or you might have even discussed it with the artist over a coffee before. You just try and think of something fun that you can try.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter if it doesn't work. In fact, it's equally as useful if it doesn't work, because you need to set up this atmosphere where it's okay to try something and then to try something else.
That's right.
There's no good going in with an idea and sticking to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It doesn't always pan out like
that. Yes, most of the time, you will need to pivot.
Yeah.
That's great. How did you end up in the frame for that record?
I'm not entirely sure. I think Alan Mulder recommended me, because I'd done a few records that he'd mixed. But I'm not entirely sure. I think I'd just been one of those guys that sort of been floating around.
Sure.
And sort of slowly. I mean, they did try like several other people before me. And,
okay.
And then we actually did Spanish Sahara in Flood Studio in Willesden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And used his Cool Up 2600 and lots of other cool things. We did that off click to tape.
Okay.
Actually.
Wow.
Which.
Just
Which
to make your
bold.
Life as hard as possible.
And that was quite different. I mean, I'm very proud of that album, but I'm not sure that I would approach albums in the same way now I'm a lot older. It was very much like we were looking to try and make something like really, like a real statement, something really, sort of really mind blowing.
Mm.
And I think we did. And I'm very proud of the record, but I think maybe like we worked too hard.
Okay.
I think that now I've got a bit more experience, I'd like to think I can get somewhere sort of similar by doing less.
So there's a balance to be had between you set out both kind of extremes of the less is more, letting it happen, but also you did say that working hard can get you great results.
Yeah, I think you still have to work really hard.
Yes.
But I think like however old I was, like 25 or something when I did that.
Wow.
30. I don't know, to be honest.
Somewhere in that region, yeah.
I think that I didn't have as much experience as I do now. And in a way, you know, when you're like, you listen to like recordings that you made when you're 20 years old and you think, wow, that's actually quite good.
Yeah. We talk about this a lot. Yeah, yeah.
Mm. I mean, in a way, it's distance. And you're not seeing the same cracks that you were seeing when you were young.
Yes.
Yes.
But in a way, it's also probably a purer intention. Mm. You know, you're turning the bass drum up because it sounds cool.
Yeah.
You're not turning it up because you want to trigger the mix bus compressor.
Mm. Yeah.
You know.
I think there's something to be said for naivety
in all of this stuff.
So we kind of learn and then we unlearn, and I think that that's actually, you know, you could say the same with music. I guess if you've studied music, I mean, I haven't really, but the if you sort of like learn all the modes and you learn all of your hot licks on the guitar,
yeah.
If you want to be if you're a technical person, that's great. But if you want to sort of be as free as possible, you might want to try not to think too much about the modes, or you might end up getting stuck in a certain place.
I think there is a tightrope to be walked there.
Yeah, so I think it's kind of good to, I guess that's craft, right? You learn why something works technically. You work really hard at trying to achieve it, and then you try to forget it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I sometimes think in bands, that's a good way that you can almost have those two personalities. I think the really best bands are where you have someone who is like a grade 8 guitar player and only wants the purest, perfectly composed song. Mm. And then someone else in the band who's just like, does it sound good when I play it loud to my friends? And then like, if you have those two egos crushing against each other, that can be a way of getting that almost.
It's contrast, isn't it? It's contrast is always useful, I think, in any sort of creative endeavor. And yeah, having different people offering different perspectives is always good.
Recently, you worked with Keaton Henson on some of his work and his albums and EPs. And he seems like someone with a very particular vision and a way of saying things. And and you've worked with a lot of people like that through your career, but that's someone recently. And how do you facilitate that with an artist? You talked a bit like with Foles there of kind of going and spending that time with them.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I did with Keaton as well. I did go and spend time with him at his place. I've done three records with him now. The first record, we met and he said that he didn't like big production sort of sessions. Didn't really like sort of being behind the glass and he didn't really like the whole sort of studio scenario. So I said, well, why don't we just come and build a studio in your house? And I'll show you how to record. I'll do you a 10-point list of engineering. Mm-hmm. I'll set the mics up and you can just record it yourself.
Amazing.
So that's what we did.
Yes.
We went and set up some really cool mics and sorted out with a whole new Logic system, and because he uses Logic and a computer and everything, and I lent him some cool preamps and we set it up so that we would get like a really great sound, and he would just print a certain amount of channels with every pass, and then I'd have a choice on rooms or because he's not the sort of guy that you edit.
Sure.
He does something and it's generally amazing.
Yeah, I'll bet.
I got that feel, yeah.
That's actually links in nicely to what we were just talking about. That was a sort of peak do less.
Yeah, that's the definition of hands-off production. Yeah.
And then I was actually in Seoul in Korea and he was sending me music. He was generally finishing recording at like 1 a.m. And I was generally just having my second coffee.
Yeah.
And so he was sending me the music as he was printing, and we were discussing it and maybe talking a bit about mics and a little bit, but mostly just about, you know, whether he felt like he had nailed it and whether it was the right mood.
Yeah.
And I think that works for Keaton. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Because he knows what he's doing and he knows what he wants. He doesn't need me telling him to try again.
Did Phil Selway play some drums on that record as well?
Yes, he was amazing, Philip.
What was it like tracking someone like that?
It was a dream.
Yeah.
It was incredible. And I was just totally starstruck. And he sounds, even when he plays a shaker, he sounds like a Radiohead record.
Wow.
But more than that, I think Philip was amazing, not just because of his incredible skill as a musician, but just his vibe is the best. Mm. He just is so cool.
Right.
And having him in the room, like, I think makes everything better. He's just really nice, really positive. He sees beauty in lots of things. And I think it's just he's just a great guy to have around. You know, I think he would make any session better.
Let's just jump back to talking about your career path a little bit, because this is something we've explored a bit, and it's kind of relevant to both of us as coming from like the artist world and then going into production.
Yeah.
And you seem to move fairly swiftly from your artist career to start producing other acts.
Yeah.
Obviously you'd gained a lot of experience alongside your artist work.
Yeah.
But could you talk to us a bit about that transition and how it happened?
So basically, I guess from the Game Boy Music, I was doing sessions and in lots of bands. And then I used to work in a bar in Soho when that was cool.
Yeah.
And in that bar, we used to do sort of experimental jams before the sort of guitar soloists found out it was good. We used to sort of do really interesting things in there. And we ran a club night, which was basically anything as long as it was fun.
Yeah.
Cool. And there was a bunch of us that would DJ there. And then we made some music to play there, which ended up being Claw.
Right.
And, wow, cool. We just made that in my bedroom when I was living in Borough.
What was that club night called?
The club night, I think, was called Bad Bunny.
Okay.
Yeah, it was like 2000 and early something.
I'm sure that we'll have some listeners who remember.
Yes. Yeah, so then we got picked up after doing a demo of three tracks.
Okay.
Jimmy Smith at Parlophone played it to Dan Keeling, who really loved it. They wanted to hear a fourth track, and we didn't have a fourth track, so we took the first track and reversed it.
Uh-huh.
And
amazing.
And put it on the end of the CD, if you remember those.
Yeah.
And then they loved that fourth track. And funny enough, when we got to the end of the album about a year later, after being signed to Parlophone, they did request that we put that fourth track from the original offering on the album,
right,
where we had to tell them that it was in fact just another song reversed.
Was it literally just
we called it Rolk, which was right. Claw backwards,
right?
But it was just supposed to be a joke, but they were really cool to us, actually. I think they were great,
right? That makes a change.
Well, you know what, they facilitated us to make this kind of a bit, you know, experimental record.
Yeah. Which we both love, by the way. We've both been digging it out again, and
thanks very much. Thanks,
both really enjoying it.
That's Did you sort of see yourself as the producer of that record?
No, not at all. I wanted Ben Hillier to produce it.
Right.
I didn't want it to be like that at all. I mean, they were the demos, and we recorded the guitars with like a pod, a Line 6 pod.
Oh, I remember that
thing that looks like a kidney.
Yeah.
Mostly, and I had like a couple of Casio keyboards, and everything else was in the box. I mean, it's really normal now, but back then I think that was still on OS 9 on the computer.
Yeah.
It was a different world back then. I mean, lots of people were doing it, but it wasn't so common as it is now.
No.
I mean, still listening to it now, I do like it, and we did work with other people like Alan Mulder and Steve Dubb, who mixed Chemical Brothers, mixed some of the tracks as well, and they really did make it sound a lot better. but I still listen to it occasionally. I hear it now. I don't listen to it voluntarily.
Sure,
but I still think that it would have been better if we'd had some production on it.
Right.
Although maybe the guys at Parlophone were right, and maybe we captured that thing we were discussing earlier about that that naivety, that sort of innocence of young people just distorting a synth because it sounds cool.
I think there's definitely something there. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it obviously lit a spark that was something you're like, right, I'm not sure I want to do it for my band, but now I'm going to go and do it for some other bands.
Well, yeah. I mean, so basically after we did that, we released that album, we started doing the second album, and then unfortunately the band imploded, as they do.
Sure.
But during that time, we'd already met Ben to start working on some new tracks, and he did a really great job. And funnily enough, Ben sort of mentored me a bit into production. I got asked immediately, as soon as Claw finished, within like a few days, I was asked to start working with other artists.
Literally
within a few days. And I've never really been one for moping around, so just sort of thought, okay, let's try it.
Brilliant.
So started doing other bands and other artists, and... and I just accidentally fell into it. And to be honest, I never really liked... I like playing guitar and I like music, but I don't really like being the focus of anyone's attention. Okay. I'm really not into that. Yeah. I don't want to be in videos. Cool. I don't want to be in photo shoots.
Yeah.
But I do like playing guitar riffs or distorting MS-20s.
Yeah.
So it was a really good fit.
Mm.
And I found it was an accidental switch. And I was lucky enough to have... Ben Hillier on the phone if something weird was happening.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the first big sessions, I didn't really have a proper grasp of what a preamp was.
Yeah, okay.
Sure. Yeah.
Because I'd just been using sort of rubbish gear.
And so
I didn't really know. We went into the pool, which in one of its earlier iterations, when it was just a big empty space down the My Loco space down in Tower Bridge.
Yeah.
That was Ben's studio, actually. I went in there with a friend of mine, an engineer, who I'm still good friends with, and I was looking to plug the mics in around the back of the interface.
Oh right, yeah.
And then there are all these big sort of Neve pre's and APIs and whatnot. I had no idea what they were, but we just had to wing it, and we just plugged them in and just sort of right, okay, that's working now. Let's move on.
Yeah,
brilliant. Yeah, have we got a sound? Let's go.
Actually, that record sounds great. That was a Charlotte Halfley record. That sounds really good, that record. So, just goes to show you don't always need to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
I think that's a good, I don't think you worry so much about what you don't know when you're doing it as well. I think there's that panic, isn't there?
Yeah.
But if you don't know that there's the panic and it sounds good, just...
Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, we were lucky on that session to be working with incredibly good musicians, and Charlotte's an amazing musician. And when you've got someone like that, you could actually stick a 57 going into a directly into a computer, and it would sound great.
Yeah,
with her playing. So we have to remember that. Yes, we can nerd out on our stuff. It's kind of addictive, and it's awesome to have cool stuff. And I think it does make a difference if it's used properly. It does. Ultimately, the communication comes from the musician, and if it's there, it's going to be there no matter what we do.
Yeah,
I think it's nice to know that we're only to be sort of cognizant of the fact that we're only a percentage of the.
Yes, completely.
Yeah,
just a product.
Conduit. Yeah.
You know, having a really awesome £2,000 compressor is great, but it probably only makes a mild difference.
Yeah, I agree.
And there's few artists that come in and see it and go, now I know you've got that compressor, I'm just going to deliver the performance of all time.
Actually, I do think there's something cool about there's something cool about going into a studio, and there's almost sort of a religious sort of a feeling, I imagine, where you go in and you see there's these tools that you can associate to classic sort of the craft of recording.
Mm-hmm.
I'm coming in here and seeing your big Neve desk. It's cool, and there's an amount of reverence for the stuff, and it starts setting up this atmosphere that you're not just doing something on your own, and where you're unsure whether it's good or not. You're validated because you're in this this is a temple of recording, and having even if you don't use the gear, having some lights on and a couple of cool bits and bobs knocking around. And sets up this this atmosphere of validation for your creativity, and I think that we should sort of revere our recording equipment, and it should be something that we love to look at and be around, because I think it enables us. It's like if you walk into a big artist studio and there's paint all over the floor and these huge canvases, immediately you're activated into a certain zone.
Yeah,
and I think that the same is true in studios. That's why when you go to Maida Vale or Real World or any of these big studios, just seeing the photographs when you're in the lobby is enough to sort of get you excited and put you in the right zone.
I think it's a great point. I think you're also enabling everyone's gear acquisition syndrome.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Although I have a one in, one out policy at the moment.
That's a good.
So if you buy something, you have to sell something else.
That's a good place to be.
It's taken me a long time to get there, and I'm quite slow at the selling. But I mean, theoretically, it's.
Got you. Well, there's one more thing I wanted to get in, which was just you guys have worked together. So let's just briefly go over your memories of that, if you don't mind.
It's funny when you were talking then about the studio as a space, having been in bands and now been on the other side, and also just being older and having more perspective, I wish I would have enjoyed. I think when you're in a band, there's that pressure, isn't there, when you go into a studio the label's putting up money or we're putting up money. And I think I was always focused on the end product and sort of getting the sign off from the band and the management and hoping it would give you that global number one smash. But what I really remember about the time we spent in the studio, and now I really value it, is you approach the creation of the song we'd bought as something to be creative in that moment in the studio over the 2 days. We'd written everything on Logic. It was very much in the box. I think we had images in our head that we were not really even a band, and we were sort of dance music adjacent because that was what we thought.
Yeah.
And you sort of took it all out of the box for us, and you actually made us all sit in a room together and make a live electro record, basically. Which actually then informed how we made the record later on.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, because when we then went to work with Alex later, we had it in our heads that we could all sit around and play this music because we'd done it with Luke and it had been really fun.
I kind of remember really us referencing Silver Apples and Fad Gadget and early sort of live electronica stuff.
Yeah.
Do you remember
you set
that?
Me up with an SH-101 and the drummer with sampled drums, but he had to play them. And
yeah, they were triggering really cool. through little contact mics. Triggering.
That's
a MIDI
right.
thing,
yeah, yeah, on the Pelly case.
That's right. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is what we were talking about earlier, like just doing something a little bit out there to try and sort of like kickstart a creative process, if you know what I mean.
Shakespeare once said that music is the food of love. But what is the food of music? As much as the right microphone or guitar amp, what we eat or drink can be such a crucial part of a recording session. So each week we like to ask our guests, what do they cook or order to get the mood right in the studio?
I used to actually cook when I had the studio in my house, but these days I don't cook just because I don't really have the time. Because sure. Everyone's on such, you know, we're all so busy, it seems. We've got to get everything done very quickly. So, but I mean, my main thing I would say is air. People just need to air. Like, I mean, in where we are, there's not a huge amount of choice. There's like two cafes and then one is good and one isn't. So we normally go to the good one.
that does the choice for you.
And then right? people choose whatever they want. But yeah, I mean, I think just getting out of the studio, seeing the sky, as soon as you're like 2 minutes out of the studio, everything is better.
Absolutely.
And yeah. You know, and I think, you know, weirdly you end up getting ideas and yeah. So I would love to tell you that I make a incredible food for everybody at lunchtime. And I would love to do that.
Yeah.
But I think realistically there's quite a lot of Deliveroo.
Oh yeah.
So what's your favourite studio you've ever worked in?
I might say SGS, the one in Gothenburg, just because I did a lot of projects there and it's just such a vibe.
What's your favourite plugin?
Well, I'd probably just say Pro Q3.
The EQ, right.
Yeah.
Just because it's really good. And I know that's really boring and utilitarian, but if I have to give you an even less exciting one than that, I can. And I would say Auto Align by Sound Radix, because it's really great at fixing those niggly phase issues and it makes your whole recording life better.
Okay.
Both good answers that we've not had before.
I like it. I like the utilitarian ones.
To flip it, what's your favourite piece of hardware?
Favourite piece of hardware? I don't know, to be honest. Let me think. I've got a Studer 89 console, small mastering console, and the preamps in it are just amazing and you can just plug a mic in and it just sounds cool even before anyone's doing anything. So maybe that.
What's your favourite synth?
Well, I've got too many synths. I would say
you can have more than one. You're allowed.
And my favourite synth is a synth that will probably only be working properly for the first time now. It's just been serviced for like 3 months. It's an Arp 2600.
Great.
Lovely.
But it's been a long journey getting that beast back to a functioning life. But I've used it even when it wasn't working, I was using it every day.
Amazing.
Yeah.
How did it come? Did it come to you in a sorry state, and you just sort of had to nurse it through?
Yeah. So I bought it in Tokyo before Brexit. They were doing it up because it was broken, and then Brexit happened, and it got like 20% more expensive.
Oh, bloody hell.
And then it took them a lot longer to renovate it than they thought. And then Parcelforce lost it in the back of a van for 6 months.
Oh no!
And by the time I got it had been bashed around in the back of a van. And then, yeah, so, and then it's been repaired in inverted commas multiple times. But I found a guy in North London who's given it the love it deserves, and he's set it up in his house, and he's been playing it so that he can really feel all of the problems with it. And he understands that I want it to be the best version of itself.
Great.
Rather than just switching everything out for new components. And he's basically fixed it all.
Amazing.
Wow. So it's super exciting to have it back on track for the first time in, what, 20 years or whatever it's been.
And the last of the Fast Five is, what's your favourite microphone?
Difficult choice. Probably, I mean, I find it very difficult to choose favourites. Maybe the R88, the AEA R88. Well, it's a stereo ribbon. Again, I only bought mine because Ben Hillier had one and I thought it was so cool. Mm. You can use it to capture recording very, very quickly, and it's always in phase, and you can do really cool things with it because it's two mics that are mounted in a plumb line.
Yes.
So you can use it very quickly and very accurately, and the sound is really good. And in the past, I've recorded. I mean, I just did this record for a band called Life, which we recorded in a chapel in Lincolnshire.
Wow!
And we put it in the middle of the room, and everyone played around it, and we balanced them by moving them around.
Oh, wow!
for some of the songs. And cool. Yeah, and it's like a really beautiful mic where you feel like you can really use you can use it creatively and know that you can't go wrong.
Amazing. Brilliant, thank you. Well, and there's just one more question that we ask everyone. What's the most important tool at your disposal as a producer?
I guess it would be something like empathy or like trying to understand what the artist wants. I think it's not the right word, but I think that you just have to try and understand how the person you're working with is feeling,
yeah,
what they want, and how you can make that happen,
yeah,
in the most productive way.
Oh, thanks so much to Luke for that interview. We really, really enjoyed it. Lawrence, what was your big takeaway?
Well, I thought it was really interesting to hear him talk about that Foles record and the processes they all went through to make it, because mm-hmm. I remember that record being made quite well. Like, Foles had exploded onto the scene and like had a chart record, and it was such a big deal, their first record, Antidotes. And as he said, like, I wanted to bypass the difficult second album and make the epic third album. And that must have been a lot of pressure that he's alluding to, but like sort of in a nice way skirting over as well. And
yeah,
they so delivered with that second album. It shifted everyone's view of that band from mm-hmm. a really exciting, inverted commas, indie rock act mm-hmm. to like a serious rock proposition. And mm-hmm. early in their career, I just thought it was fascinating to hear him talk about that process mm-hmm. of doing that. And it made you think about something about that he sort of alluded to while doing that and his lessons from that, didn't it?
Well, I think the big contrast or almost contradiction between two things, and I think obviously it's about a balance between these two things, that he talked about how as his career's gone on, he's done less and less.
Mm-hmm.
Or he's talked about as his career's gone on, he's tried to do less and to get more natural and better results. Mm. I think it's maybe the best way to sum it up. But mm-hmm. he also talks about how he's kind of proud of how hard they worked on the record. And he talks about how if you want to do something great, you do have to work hard.
Yeah,
like there aren't shortcuts. So I guess it's something that we're all trying to find as creative professionals. What is the balance between working our asses off, but also letting the creation happen naturally? Because it's just one of these things that you can try and grab onto something too hard, and it can slip mm-hmm. out of your grasp. And if you let something happen, maybe you're more likely to get a better result if you let it happen naturally. However, there's still a lot of hard work that needs to go in. So how do you strike that balance?
A few producers have talked about it in different mm-hmm. ways, and I've got different experiences of it. And I think, you know, Catherine Marks talked about how, like, when she made the Big Moon record, that they just had 2 weeks, and there were certain time restrictions, and they just sort of blasted through it. And other producers have talked about where they've been involved in big projects where they're 6 months in and they're like, is this song any better than it was 2 weeks in? And it's so hard to quantify. And maybe that is at times the producer's job to go like, guys, we've just got to go down a rabbit hole for 5 days.
Yeah.
And then other times just go, that take was the first take and we're not going to do another one, because why would we waste our time when it's brilliant? And Luke's talking about how he now has that experience of that to be maybe able to make that judgment better, perhaps. Another thing that I really liked about Luke, and I think about this a lot when I think about making records now, with the way we can make them in so many different ways, how he talked about the reverence of making a record, of how going into these spaces can almost be holy in a way and set a mood and a tone and almost a belief about what you're going to do. And that can almost in a way have a value beyond the like, oh, that has a really nice boost at 2K if we use it.
Yeah,
it's to see that and be near it and what it's done and what it means and what the space means and what you're about to create. Because that's what I now remember from making records and what I want when I go to make records. That sense of like, gosh, we're going to make something and we could make it a million different ways, but we're going to be in this moment in this space to do it. And that's like a beautiful thing to be able to
do. And who knows what the outcome's going to be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It was also when he was talking about the reverence for the space and the gear. It was kind of the best argument I've ever heard for investing in nice gear. Mm-hmm. And as you allude to, it wasn't about like, oh, this one's got a really nice presence boost at 2K. It was about just the philosophical approach to the creativity and putting some power in the tools of our craft. And I think that's beautiful, and I do agree with him.
As things become so utilitarian and it's brilliant and it gives us so many options, why do we have these spaces to create? And it goes throughout society without getting too deep. And it's because we're sociable creatures. It's because it's fun. And
yeah,
from my experiences, the best records I've ever made were when we went in to capture a moment that we had been working on and dedicated a time to do it, rather than when we spent multiple times, multiple hours, different eras, trying to create or capture one thing that we thought we had to do and used every tool possible to do it.
Yeah.
I understand that for certain projects, that's what you have to do, but generally I've found that an unfulfilling process.
And yeah, completely
I think
agree.
Luke expressed why I might have found it that way really well in that.
Yeah.
Mate, we've gone deep on a couple here. So I want to end with a slightly less serious, but still fascinating one.
Oh yeah, I know what we can talk about here then.
Yeah. Game music's changed a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, I was playing games. I probably played some of the games that Luke worked on.
Sure.
If you remember, right back at the beginning of the interview, he was talking about like programming in 8-bit stuff by like, you know, using DOS or whatever the system
whatever
was to like
the system would have
type
been,
in
yeah.
the frequency of the note. And just like if you think compare that to the gaming industry now, like when they're getting people to write music, like it's much closer to film music scoring mm-hmm. than it is to some dudes like tapping away on an Atari in Shoreditch.
And like, I believe like the gaming industry is now bigger than the film industry. It's a complete comparison that's worth making. And
yeah, amazing. Well, what a brilliant interview.
A brilliant interview. And it comes in the middle of a really exciting run. Our next episode is an interview with Burke Reed, Australian producer, worked with DZ Death Rays and Courtney Barnett, amongst many others. And that is another philosophical, mind-bending journey mm-hmm. into the process of a great producer, just like this one was with Luke. So yeah. We really look forward to bringing you that. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
See you next time.